even though that's what the patient said he didn't want, because it's safer than getting into a rhubarb with the family. Senate Bill 20 would require the doctor to follow the directive. And if he's not willing to do that, then he must resign from the case. We don't say he has to do that which his whole being says he can't do. That's going too far. But if he's not willing to do what the patient has said he wants done, the doctor should resign, and the law, Senate Bill 20, would require that he resign. Similarly, the healthcare facility, hospital, if not willing to follow the doctor's instructions or the patient's instructions, will assist in transferring the patient to another facility. Now, we don't require that the new doctor or the new facility be one that will follow the directive. We just require that there be a transfer to a new doctor or to a new hospital. Let them deal with the situation. A very important change, and one which Senator Riles talked about, is clearly including within the definition of life-sustaining procedures artificial and mechanical provision for nutrition and hydration. Except care necessary to sustain and promote the patient's comfort. In other words, when food and water administered through feeding tubes are necessary because of hunger pangs and thirst, they will be provided. The law would not permit tubes to be withdrawn in those circumstances. But when the patient has gone beyond that and his body doesn't want food and water anymore, or if he's in a coma and cannot have any sense of food and water being provided, in those circumstances, artificial, that is, feeding tubes, are considered a life-sustaining procedure which can properly be withdrawn. The medical community has concluded that those are indeed life-sustaining procedures, just as much as a respirator, which helps a person to breathe, another very basic function. And the American Medical Association has concluded that it is ethical to withdraw nutrition and hydration. And that was a big step by the AMA, which for years, under the common conception of the Hippocratic Oath, felt you had to do everything possible to keep the patient alive. But the oath says, I'm of course abbreviating it, but it's do no harm. And so the Doctors Professional Association has concluded that it is ethical, thus it is doing no harm to withdraw artificial nutrition and hydration in appropriate circumstances. We are trying to have Oregon step to the forefront on this and join those other states, of which there are probably about 15, which have so legislated. The present law deals with two situations. It deals with the directive in the precise form and says that that shall be the form that's allowed. And it deals with a comatose patient who is in a terminal condition, who executed no directive, and allows life-sustaining procedures, but not feeding tubes, to be withdrawn from that terminal comatose patient. All well and good, but there's a host of situations that it does not cover, and by covering those that it does, suggests that maybe the others are beyond the pale. So the law makes a lot of people very nervous, because what do you do with a patient who's about to die, but you could keep going with $1,000 to $5,000 per day life-sustaining procedures for a couple of more days at great emotional cost to the family and pain to the patient, but there's no directive. Can you let that patient go? Under the present law, it's not clear. And most tragically, what do you do with a permanently comatose patient who may not technically be terminal, but whose life has ended for all practical purposes? There's no consciousness there and never will be. Do you keep that patient going for the rest until finally and gradually peters out, maybe 9 or 10 years down the road? Is that the humane thing to do? Is that what our society requires? We think those things need changing. And that's what we're trying to do with this law. And finally, Senate Bill 21, a very straightforward measure drawn from the California counterpart, but simplified. California tends to overdo everything, as we know. In order to permit a person to appoint an agent to make these difficult decisions when a person can no longer make them for himself, which is the best way to plan ahead. Find somebody you know and love and trust and say, when the time comes, you make these decisions for me. That's what 21 does. We really heard no opposition to that during our hearings. I think that summarizes what the bill does, and I very much appreciate your attention. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Dr. Payne?
Thank you. Dr. Roy Payne, private practice in Milwaukee. I'm a geriatrician, and I take care of a lot of dying patients. Before you is my testimony, which is 20 and 21, Senate bill. Before public testimony started on this bill, and with Mr. Shoemaker, the Multnomah County Medical Society spent literally hundreds of physician hours and staff hours preparing the groundwork to develop this presentation and testimony that was subsequently heard throughout the state. There are national court cases and unpublicized local problems that have necessitated our participation in this bill. For one, we had one patient who was terminally ill, and the physician shut down aggressive care, was going to allow the patient to die, and the reviewer for the state assistance came around, disagreed with the doctor, put the nursing home into receivership, and created a great deal of trauma addressing some of the problems that were here. If we had this bill, we could have avoided that kind of trauma. In addition, now OMPRO is trying to, Oregon Medical Professional Review Organization, the federally mandated review for Medicare services, feels that if the patient, Medicare patient is in the hospital and a no code is written on the chart, that in a sense reduces the service under Medicare, is taking away service from Medicare, and the physician must justify that no code order. This law then will help to address that particular question under OMPRO. So this bill addresses problems we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. We have patients in the intensive care unit. We have patients who are going to die, and we need to address how we care for them and how we sustain them and how long we sustain them with artificial means. Multnomah County Medical Society, the Oregon Medical Association, the Hospital Association, many other groups have testified and carried forward with this in this bill that is before you at this time. The expansion of these concepts in determining one's own care in terminal and comatose situations will assist the physicians in their care of these patients. And this bill will be helpful in providing meaningful and really caring services to the dying patient in the future. this bill does not address the infant question, and we had no intention of addressing that question in the bill that you have before. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, all three of you again. All right. And Mr. Castagna, please. Mr. Castagna is being called as a witness to present the opposition overview. You have just heard the proponent's overview of the task force work, and now the opposition overview.
Thank you, Chairman Frey, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Robert Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference is the public policy office of the Archdiocese of Portland, Western Oregon, and the Diocese of Baker, Eastern Oregon, serving the state's Roman Catholic population of approximately 325,000 Oregonians. As the Church's public policy office, the Oregon Catholic Conference is authorized to represent to the legislature and the public the Church's official position on public policy issues. Although you may hear testimony on the issues raised in Senate Bills 20 and 21 from a number of witnesses in the Roman Catholic tradition, the Oregon Catholic Conference is the office duly authorized to represent the Church on this and other legislation being considered by the 64th Oregon Legislative Assembly. At the outset of this testimony, may I acknowledge to you and the public the importance and complexity of the issues raised in Senate Bills 20 and 21. The issues of life and death, living and dying, living in dignity and with reasonable care until the moment of death, present some of the most complex and possibly preeminent moral issues of our day. Since each of us will one day certainly face our own death, the issues presented in Senate Bills 20 and 21 touch the lives of each one of us gathered here today. It is quite appropriate that the hearings on these bills begin during the period of Lent, a time for Christians worldwide to reflect on our own mortality and our call to eternal life. The Oregon Catholic Conference has been involved in the discussion of life-sustaining treatment legislation for approximately 2 years. Senate Bill 812 was introduced on March 20, 1985, to amend and to repeal certain provisions of ORS Chapter 97 containing Oregon's existing statutory law on rights with respect to terminal illness, and that's Exhibit A in your packet. Due to the expected early adjournment of the legislative session and the concern that not enough time was left to adequately consider the issues raised by Senate Bill 812, and to involve all interested parties in the discussion, an interim task force was appointed to consider Draft J of Senate Bill 812. The Oregon Catholic Conference was and continues to be interested and involved in the discussion and debate concerning life-sustaining treatment legislation. I personally attended all the hearings and work sessions held by the Senate Interim Task Force recommending Senate Bills 20 and 21. Declaring our willingness to work with the task force, I testified in Portland on March 21, 1986 as follows. We urge this task force to examine legislative proposals on this issue with the utmost care and deliberation because the proposals themselves will deal with life and death in our society. We wish you well in your assignment and we will study with you the various proposals and issues that come before you. At the outset of the task force study, then, the Oregon Catholic Conference participated in a neutral position regarding a review of the issue. The conference suggested to the task force issues for discussion and did not adopt a position on the task force's work until the task force formulated its decisions on the policy questions involved at its last work session on September the 18th, 1986. In reviewing the task force's policy decisions as reflected in SB 20 and 21, however, the conference declares its opposition to both bills. The conference submits that both bills will open the door to the practice of euthanasia in the state of Oregon, a policy substantially and seriously deviating from the current public policy of the state and bad public policy for the people of Oregon. In the official teaching of the Catholic Church, there are certain key documents that set forth the Church's teaching and understanding on euthanasia and life-sustaining treatment legislation. Among these documents contained in your packets are Exhibit B, the Vatican Declaration on Euthanasia, Exhibit C, Guidelines for Legislation on Life-Sustaining Treatment, and Exhibit D, Statement on the Uniform Rights of the Terminally Ill Act. These documents, while setting forth principles growing out of a specific religious tradition, appeal to a common respect for the dignity of the human person rather than to any specific denominational stance. We see them as especially appropriate to a society which, whatever its moral and political pluralism, was founded on the belief that all human beings are created equal as bearers of the inalienable right to that most dignified and sacred of all God's gift, human life itself. And might I add, parenthetically, in addressing Senate Bills 20 and 21, we seek not to impose our beliefs, but to fully participate in the political process and the debate on these bills as the legislature shapes the public policy of the state of Oregon. At the outset of this committee's hearings on these bills, it would be good for the committee to consider the distinction between public policy as contained in law and what is considered moral in the discussions of a particular issue among moral theologians. The worlds of law and morality are not equal. They are not coterminous. A classic example illustrates this distinction. If a person steals a loaf of bread to starve a feeding to feed a starving family, the act of stealing is not an immoral act, but the act is illegal. The circumstances may mitigate the penalty, but the act itself is an illegal act. The law is designed to address general public policy positions for the good of society, not the difficult cases at the extreme. The maxim, hard cases make bad law, calls itself to our attention in the issues raised by Senate Bills 20 and 21. In general terms, three critical issues present themselves for initial consideration in SB 20 and 21. And these issues are the overall scope of the legislation, its discussion of nutrition and hydration, and its implications for unborn children. Number one, the scope of the legislation. Catholic moral teaching traditionally discusses the legitimacy of withdrawing life-sustaining treatment in terms of a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary means. The Church rejects euthanasia, a term which encompasses both acts and omissions intended to cause death in order to end suffering, and it rejects the withdrawal of ordinary means as, quote, equivalent to euthanasia, unquote. But it sees extraordinary means as morally optional. Two factors can render life-sustaining treatment extraordinary. Either it provides no benefit, or its use involves excessive burdens. In keeping with its teaching on the dignity of handicapped individuals, Catholic tradition would oppose the idea that life itself may be regarded as non-beneficial or burdensome because of its condition. It can be argued that Oregon's existing living will law respects these distinctions, primarily because of its limited scope. It deals only with patients who are in a terminal condition and where death is imminent, and, quote, where the application of life-sustaining procedures serve only to postpone the moment of death of the patient. That's ORS 97.050 sub 6. The directive to physicians set forth as part of ORS 97.055 establishes the criteria of terminal condition and imminent death as prerequisites for application of Oregon's statutory public policy on rights with respect to terminal illness. And that statute is set forth in my testimony. Both SB 20 and 21 attempt to reach a much broader class of patients, such as patients in debilitated conditions who may live a long time with treatment, but who will die quickly without it. This expanded scope can be used to authorize omissions which are equivalent to euthanasia, unless it is further specified that only treatment whose use involves excessive burdens can be withdrawn. SB 21 presents the clearest example of the problem because it explicitly includes all kinds of patients, whether terminal or not, and life-sustaining means including, quote, mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration, unquote. Decisions in accordance with SB 21 could encompass decisions to practice euthanasia by omission or to discriminate against mentally or physically handicapped citizens by denial of ordinary and customary means for sustaining life. The potential for abuse is also great because this bill gives legally binding force to judgments made by a third party based on the signature of the principal without informed consent regarding the particular details of the medical situation in which the principal may find himself or herself. It would be unrealistic to imagine that the principal at the time of signing can give detailed instruction or informed consent regarding specific future treatments. In practice, the power is that of the proxy, whose own judgment as to the patient's best interests may easily be colored by discriminatory judgments as to the relative value of handicapped lives. It was on the basis of just such a best interest judgment that the Indiana courts sanctioned the death by dehydration of the Bloomington baby in 1982. Medical moral commentators disagree on the appropriate legislative response to this case, but were almost unanimous in denouncing the case itself. In Senate Bill 21, notwithstanding Section 15, which suggests only the power to allow the natural process of dying, the durable power of attorney may encompass the power to make medical treatment decisions for adults along the same lines. In our view, such a result would not be prevented by disclaimers that quote-unquote, patient comfort must be maintained. Bloomington baby scenarios have often involved sedation to alleviate the discomfort of dehydrating to death. The point of such cases is that routine surgery and means to provide nourishment and fluids were withdrawn from a handicapped individual precisely because handicapped life was not seen as worth living. The safeguards against such decisions in the Power of Attorney Act do not seem adequate, particularly when some commentators automatically define a person unable to feed or care for himself as, in quote, the natural process of dying, unquote. A similar potential for abuse can be seen in SB 20, though this may not be apparent on first reading. This bill also extends to many patients who will not inevitably die soon. To fulfill the conditions of the bill, one apparently need only be in the active and natural process of dying, a vague phrase which could conceivably include all living human beings, or at least all who are senior citizens. In one sense, we are all in the natural process of dying. Three alternative suggestions are made in SB 20 for the patient's declaration, and two of these alternatives pose the problem of abuse, while the third is so extreme as to be of little use. In short, none of the three in SB 20, on page 2 of the bill, reflect the traditional distinction between morally obligatory and morally optional means. To be specific, on page 2 of SB 20, alternative 1 seems to offer a burden and benefit test, but suggests that one should judge the burdens and benefit of living, specifically of living with a low, quote-unquote, quality of life, unquote, rather than the benefits and burdens of specific treatments. Thus, a discriminatory judgment about the relative value of life based on mental and physical perfections is imported into the decision. This document could easily be used to practice euthanasia by omission, by which I mean a decision in which treatment is omitted in order to end a life on the basis that this life contains either too few benefits or too many sufferings to be worth living. Alternative number 2 makes a similar judgment, but in some ways a more arbitrary one. Apparently, all treatment technically possible is to be provided until the patient is in a coma, diagnosed as irreversible, at which time all treatment, including mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration, is to be withdrawn. This also seems to be a quality of life standard, one in which unconscious life is seen as no longer having the positive value otherwise to be accorded human life. Alternative number 3 presents an option which is not intrinsically wrong, but which will seem extreme to most people, including many conscientious Catholics. It demands levels of treatment which traditionally morality has never seen a moral obligation to provide. Thus, even if one wished to approve a choice bill which allowed a morally acceptable document as one option among many, a legislative judgment which presents moral problems of its own, this alternative would not be a useful one. Addressing the issue of nutrition and hydration, some Catholic moralists see the provision of nourishment and fluids as part of an ordinary nursing care to be continued in virtually all circumstances. Others see these as subject to the same burden-benefit test as other means for sustaining life. But on the second view, the law should establish a strong presumption in favor of continued use of these particular means because they are generally effective at sustaining life and seldom impose grave burdens of expense or suffering. Neither of the proposed bills respects this presumption. Both of them explicitly provide for removal of artificial means for providing food and fluids whenever more aggressive and burdensome life-sustaining measures are discontinued. Particularly in light of the broad scope of each bill, this broad policy on withdrawing food and water might be used to implement a policy of ending lives seen as not worth living. On pregnancy, although Senate Bill 21 provides that a proxy may not order an abortion on behalf of a patient, neither it nor the life-sustaining treatment bill provides for treatment to ensure an unborn child's survival when treatment would otherwise be withdrawn from his or her mother. Provisions to ensure such treatment have been incorporated into many living will laws. The Catholic Health Association of the United States sees such provisions as essential and has pointedly criticized the Uniform Rights of the Terminally Ill Act for inadequate treatment of this subject. Having criticized the features of both bills that raise the most fundamental moral problems, I would like to turn to various other features of both bills. One, neither bill makes it clear that it goes into effect only in cases of permanent incompetency. For example, this idea is suggested in Section 5, Subsection 2 of Senate Bill 20 in the phrase, quote, no longer able to participate knowledgeably. But this is not carried out consistently in other parts of the bill. In fact, this bill seems to have three subtly different descriptions of the mental state that triggers a declaration. I refer you to Sections 1, subsection 3B, and section 6, subsection 1B. The power of attorney bill seems to treat the inability to participate knowledgeably in decisions as synonymous with the state of being incapacitated. In all these cases, determination is made by a physician using his medical judgment, or hers. Note that this places considerable power in the hands of the physician, since his or her necessarily subjective judgment as to the patient's ability to make decisions is the determining factor in whether a declaration which is binding on the physician is triggered. The question might be raised, what is the relationship between these medical judgments of incapacity and legal judgments on incompetency that are generally made by courts of competent jurisdiction? Number two, both bills allow other parties to exercise the decision-making power that a patient would exercise for himself or herself if competent. In one sense, the power of attorney bill gives greater authority because it specifically empowers the proxy with the patient's own decision-making authority. Such authority will be virtually unreviewable since it will be difficult to interpret and enforce the bill's provision stating a duty to act in accord with the patient's wishes and best interests. But in another sense, the life-sustaining treatment bill is broader because it apparently empowers a virtually endless list of proxies, including casual acquaintances or the physician himself, to make life and death decisions on behalf of the patient. The threat posed by this sweeping provision may intimidate some patients into making their own preferences clear in writing, but it is not an exercise in informed consent. Number three, Section 8, Subsection 4 of SB 21 provides that life-sustaining treatment will be provided or withheld or withdrawn, quote, if the principal, whether or not incapacitated, objects to the health care or to the withholding or withdrawal of the health care. This seems a reasonable provision when treatment is provided, upholding the presumption in favor of life. When, however, a patient who is incapacitated objects to the health care, the power of attorney is removed from the attorney in fact, and the, quote, case is governed by the law that would apply if there were no power of attorney for health care. Section 4, sub 1 of SB 20 provides that a patient may revoke a declaration regardless of mental condition. Under this language, a patient in a mentally unbalanced state can authoritatively refuse ordinary means of sustaining life, which he or she demanded in writing while competent, and this is not defensible on the basis of either patient autonomy or the defense of life. Number four, some will defend these bills by arguing that Oregon's existing law is too narrow, that a broader scope is necessary to protect treatment decisions involving other classes of patients. It is true that many living will laws give blanket legal immunity to a narrow range of treatment decisions, but there will always be circumstances that fall outside the scope of specific legislation. One must ask whether it is the task of such legislation to give specific directions for all possible situations, or whether it should be designed to give special advance immunity only to those decisions that are clearly within reasonable moral limits. If the latter case is true, these two bills fail the test, because their effort to reach a wider class of patients and circumstances can be used to protect decisions that are morally indefensible. With further specificity, we suggest, in SB 20, the definition of directive is too broad, in that it means any verbal or other communication by a declarant, including but not limited to, a written or oral instruction. With life itself at stake, the wave of a hand or the blink of an eye should not be determinative as to the final course of life-sustaining procedures. Number two, the legal age of majority in Oregon, 18 years of age, should be retained at the age at which one may be a qualified patient as contained in present law, ORS 97050, sub 5. The ultimate issue of deciding a course of conduct that may result in death should not be left to the sole discretion of a minor, to the exclusion of parents and influential others in the minor's life. The increasing incidence of teenage suicides underscores legitimate public concern, not a paternalistic one, in withholding from minors the ability to make exclusive and legally binding life and death decisions on life-sustaining procedures. Number three, in Section 3 of Senate Bill 20, the patient or family or both should retain the authority to designate the attending physician. In view of the power of the attending physician to terminate life-sustaining procedures, the designation of the attending physician is a critical one and should not be removed from the patient or the family. Number four, under Sections 5 and 13 of SB 20, the penalties for a physician and healthcare facility, if they fail to follow a directive or to take reasonable steps to transfer care to another physician or healthcare facility, are too severe. Charges of unprofessional conduct for the physician or suspension or revocation of license for the healthcare facility, when either or both find themselves ethically in objection to a proposed course of withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining procedures, may have a chilling effect on the pursuit of ethical treatment by both the physician or the healthcare facility. Number five, under Section 6 and 7 of SB 20, there is no informed consent of the person to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining procedures. To the extent that both sections permit a withdrawal or withholding of life-sustaining procedures and the resulting death of the patient occurs, the sections raise the constitutional issue of the taking or deprivation of life without due process of law. Number six, Section 7 chooses the arbitrary standard of being comatose for at least 60 days. In the Church's Statement on Uniform Rights of the Terminally Ill Act, we find negative judgments about the quality of life have unconscious or otherwise disabled patients have led some in our society to propose withholding nourishment precisely in order to end these patients' lives. Society must take special care to protect against such discrimination. Number seven, the standard of care in Section 9 of SB 20 for a physician, licensed health professional, or healthcare facility should not be lowered from our existing state law to a standard of who in good faith acts in substantial compliance with this act. Section 9 is tantamount to blanket immunity from civil or criminal liability for the professional and institutions involved. The conference seeks a public policy which clarifies the rights and responsibilities of health professionals without giving blanket immunity from all legal liability.
And many of us have hospitals, nursing homes, certainly the availability of all of this technology, and yet we do not use this technology in our infirmaries for our brothers and sisters as we help them to die well. And I think that's a very important point, while it is very important for us to help people live well, it is equally important for us to help people die well. It's a humane and out of our deep Christian kind of compassion that we do not prolong dying unnecessarily through the kinds of technologies. For the one technology that can delay death for one may very well prolong the dying of another. And that's why some kind of judgment has to be made in this regard. I'd like to speak a bit about hydration and nutrition because that's a very important area, I think, and one in which members in the Catholic Church are not terribly well agreed upon. We had a meeting recently, the Catholic Health Association in Boston, in Time Magazine. There's a review of this in the February 23rd issue, and we had great division among a lot of us in regard to hydration and nutrition, not only for terminally ill people, but for persistent vegetative. And this question is not really all that crystallized within the Catholic position. I think what we can say is that maybe there's a better way in which to frame this than perhaps is in the bill presently. And this is what I find very, very helpful to physicians, to families, to caregivers, as I help them go through this kind of thing. And I'd like to share that with the committee because it's been very, very helpful in my helping people to make these kinds of decisions, which are always awesome, always difficult, but often with a great amount of love. And I think we should say something like this. The provision of sustenance through artificial means, including intravenous feeding and tube feeding, shall be considered of life-prolonging procedure that may be withheld or withdrawn when such provision would only serve to prolong the process of dying, offering the patient neither benefit nor comfort. Medical nutrition and hydration may not always provide benefit or comfort to the patient. Consequently, their use must be evaluated in the same manner as any other medical procedure in terms of the proportionate benefits and burdens conferred on them by the patient. When in the judgment of a qualified practitioner, they prove to be ineffective in overcoming suffering, namely comfort, or reversing a disease process, benefit, they may be withheld or discontinued. The term life-prolonging procedure does not include oral feeding or the administration of medication or the performance of any medical procedure deemed necessary to provide comfort care or to alleviate pain. It's within this kind of concept that you often can deal with the kinds of decisions which most lovingly can be made within the value system of the patient, making those decisions in accord with the values that they have treasured in their life.
Father, is that particular terminology contained in your written remarks?
It is.
I was just looking for it here. Has counsel found that?
It's on the second sort of area under hydration and nutrition, right, on the first and the second page.
Just want to make sure we had it in the record.
Yes.
Here. All right, go ahead, sir.
I think there are three kinds of categories of people that you deal with this question. First deals with patients and families, and they're very much concerned, you know, will there be added suffering? Will there be a terrible kind of death that comes about by this? And I think what we can say, we've learned in hospice, we've learned in our religious infirmaries, that people do not overly suffer when we do not use this kind of technology. We have found ways in which to keep them adequately comfortable, enough at peace within themselves, even though quite alert in many cases, in which to accept this dying in a very humane and often religious way. We can make people comfortable. Of course, there is this point that, you know, the giving of food and water is a very basic human gesture. When you go home to mother, she always fixes you a meal. That's her way of saying, hey, I love you, I care for you, and this kind of a thing. And nobody really wants, a lot of people have this idea that when we're withdrawing food and water, we're pulling the tray out from a patient that's hungry and wants to eat. That's not what we're talking about at all. And so, but it is a very precious kind of a thing to say we can offer that comfort in the best way that is possible in this particular kind of situation. The opposite of providing is abandonment, and nobody wants abandonment. And we have to develop the kinds of way in which we can care for people. Unfortunately, some of the financial arrangements, when you are not aggressive and heroic, then nobody's going to pay for this sort of care for someone in this lingering kind of state. And that's a real problem for many people. The second group of people are professional caregivers and providers. And they're very hesitant to raise the question about food and water and this kind of thing, because they're terribly trained to be aggressive, to stave off death. And they want to use all the talents and the technology and things that they have learned. But at the same time, we have to train them to also offer comfort, because when you can no longer care, then you have to transfer your efforts when you can no longer cure, then you have to transfer those efforts into caring. And that's a real art, the art of medicine, and that's something that is terribly important. There's a lot of fear of litigation in regard to this, and especially people have this myth of maintenance, as I call it, that it's much harder to withdraw something that started than to start it in the beginning. But from an ethical point of view, withholding or withdrawing is not of a consequence. They're of the same kind of category. Also, I think when it comes to the public, to the politicians, to churches, I think they do us a service in the sense that they raise the question that some people who are voiceless, vulnerable, powerless within our society, there could be abuse in regard to these kinds of things, and therefore we need to pay attention to that. And I think I laud them in the sense of saying that this is something that people need to pay attention to. But at the same time, we can get ourselves into a kind of a bind that we become so cautious that we don't allow some people to exercise the rights that is there. Really, what often happens is we use a kind of an axiom which isn't correct. The possibility of abuse by one demands the non-use by all. And you'll find through a lot of ethics in a variety of ways in which this is it. I'd like to just conclude with a quote from Archbishop Mahoney of Los Angeles, who recently gave his reflections in regard to this. He said, if taking food artificially or even naturally, in the patient's honest judgment, is a source of significant pain, discomfort, risk, and even dehumanization, added to what he is already experiencing or will experience from his condition, no one can defend the patient's right to say no more.
Thank you, Father, for being here with us very much. Rabbi Rose, please.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not an attorney addressing details of the bill, which I'm sure will be straightened out as difficulties are discovered. I am addressing essentially the spirit of what is here. I also should say that I'm somewhat humbled by the experiences of some of the speakers who preceded me, but I nevertheless would like to share with you essentially what my view is. I've testified many times in the past on a variety of bills which I've considered to be important. Never has my presence elicited more sober reflection. We also cross a line today that normally I do not like to cross at the legislature, namely the separation principle, but in this matter it becomes necessary. Everyone who appears here today is a strong believer in the sacredness of life. I have the highest regard for the views of those who disagree with the bills now under consideration, but our perceptions of sacredness of life differ in certain fine nuances. There is a time to be born and there is a time to die. And when that time comes, we should be able, and indeed must be able, for the sake of our individual and collective mental health, to be able to accept the fact that we die. We must learn to let go of others, and we must ourselves learn to let go. Death is part of life, and to artificially sustain life under certain circumstances is to teach of death as being a defeat rather than part of the cycle of which we are all a part. The essence of my very brief statement to you is that I can discover no ethical requirement to force a person to live under certain circumstances. I do not view this legislation as enabling any positive act to hasten death. This we may not do. We are not talking about euthanasia. The legislation enables us, in certain circumstances, to remove the causes of the delay of death, to permit death to come naturally by removing that which hinders death. We are not bound to force a person to live. On the contrary, when we are dealing with these kinds of situations, a person is entitled to die. Our only obligation at that point is to keep the patient as free of pain as is possible and as comfortable as is possible. In my opinion, however, the physician has no ethical duty to keep a patient alive a little longer. The Jewish Sea of Wisdom has given much attention to this subject throughout many years. The Talmud and post-Talmudic literature is replete with dilemmas raised by the very question that you as legislators are dealing with. Were I to select one area that strikes me as being of greatest expertise in Jewish literature, it is in regard to the mastery of the human condition. And in the many pages dealing with this dilemma, against the background of the sacredness of life, which guides virtually all its deliberations, its wisdom is simple. We may take no positive action to hasten death, but we are not required to force a person to live under circumstances under discussion today. I should add that I have no difficulty in disagreeing with some positions which have come down from my religious history. Indeed, new knowledge in certain areas requires disagreement with certain of those teachings. That history was written by human beings just like you and me, struggling to understand and to discern as much as we can about the human condition. In this instance, however, while modern science has complicated the process of making certain moral decisions, I personally feel totally comfortable with the historical position, which totally coincides with my own analysis and my own struggle with the question before us. I'd like to add one note, if I may. We live in a lawsuit-crazy society. Many superb physicians are leaving fields in which they are expert because of fear of being sued. There are, I am certain, some incompetent physicians, and our regulations in one way or another must root them out. But the fear of lawsuits has not really forced physicians to become more conservative. It is taking away their ability to make judgments. And this, I suggest, has brought us to where we are today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Rose, very much for being here. And now the Reverend Robert Burton, please.
You have the information and the testimony in
yes,
the green
we do, sir.
Folder. I'm Robert Burtner. I live in Eugene. I'm reading the testimony of Bishop Calvin McConnell, the Bishop of the United Methodist Church. He has asked me to read his words to you, partly because the situation which he describes in his testimony still has a deep effect on his emotions. The heart-wrenching experience that Bishop McConnell tells about in this testimony is not unusual in my 40 years experience as a pastor, where I've seen the need several times for clear legal guidelines which will allow persons to, and here I quote our social principles of the United Methodist Church, die in dignity, with loving personal care, and without efforts to prolong terminal illnesses merely because the technology is available to do so.
We have Mr. McConnell's letter, of course.
Right, that's what I'm reading, yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be necessary, because we have already read it, it wouldn't be necessary for you to read all of it. Maybe you could...
Just the salient points.
You would, yeah.
Yeah. The point that he's raising is about his wife. My wife, Mary, died of cancer a year ago in April. Her death came after 2 years of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy treatments. She fought her disease valiantly, intelligently, and hopefully. At the beginning of the second year of this experience, she felt that it was desirable for her to make arrangements concerning her future medical treatment, since it appeared that it might not be able to control the spread of the cancer. With the assistance of an attorney, she made out a legal document of directive to physicians. In it, she directed that her life should not be artificially prolonged if, in the opinion of two physicians, her condition was determined to be terminal. The document specified that there were to be no life-sustaining procedures which would only serve to artificially prolong the moment of death if, in the opinion of her attending physician, it was determined that her death was imminent whether or not life-saving procedures were utilized. It was her intent in this directive that she be permitted to die naturally. She then discussed it with her family, with her attending physician, so that everyone who might be involved with decisions concerning her treatments would be aware of her desires. She felt this to be necessary, particularly in the event that she would not be able physically or mentally to participate in such decision. 7 months later, I sat with her in the physician's office when he told her that there was nothing further that could be done medically to stop the ravages of the cancer, which had spread throughout her body, including her brain. The next half hour, she was able to work through with him the ways in which she could be cared for as she faced her impending death. It was agreed that only medications for pain control would be used, and that if any surgery were required, it would be only for purposes of her comfort or for convenience of those who were caring for her. She then went home to die. God was merciful to her in that her death came about 1 month later. Through the unique form of care offered by hospice through St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland, she was able to remain in her home, surrounded by her family and friends, as she quietly and quickly slipped toward her death. As painful as her death has been for her family and me, we have the satisfaction of knowing that she received the type of medical aid that allowed her to die in the manner she desired. She died naturally and quickly in her own home. Nothing artificial was used to keep her alive. While I am in deep grief, yet following her death, I am grateful for the fact that she was allowed to die in the way she directed. It was easier not only for her, but for those of us who loved her and were caring for her. The method of dying was considerably easier on her than many of the methods which could have been used in attempting to prolong her life artificially. The results of such artificial methods could well have been a continuation or increase in her physical pain and her mental duress. And this, I think, is the most important sentence. When she knew nothing could be done to save her life, she had the only remaining satisfaction left to her of choosing how and where she would die. I urge the passage of the legislation which is being considered. Out of my personal experience and on the basis of theological and biblical guidelines offered by my church, I find the provisions of these bills to offer a practical and compassionate approach both for the rights of the terminally ill and for the guidance and protection of those who are charged with their care. It will do much to give dignity of choice to the terminally ill and peace of mind to those who are most intimately related with them in their treatment and care.
Thank you. And now Mr. McConnell is the resident bishop of the United
Methodist Church. That's right. He's the resident bishop of the United Methodist Church with administrative work here in Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska.
All right. Now, I probably should know this without asking you, but I want to write it down now. The location, mailing address perhaps of your own church in Eugene.
I am a district superintendent, and I live in Eugene.
Yes. Ministering in any particular church. You're
not right now. No, I just came off of that.
What's your mailing address there, please?
1582 Willa Gillespie Road.
All right.
Eugene, 97401.
Thank you very much for being here. Let's see. We have Mary Dope, please.
Senator Frey, members of the committee, I am Mary Doak. I'm a registered nurse. For the past 12 years, I have worked in long-term care. Prior to that, my experiences have been in intensive care and coronary care. It is because of the experiences in these areas of practice of nursing that I come before you today in support of Senate Bills 20 and 21. Dr. J. Gary Grant dared to ask some questions in his article, The No-Code Decision, A Doctor's Perspective. His questions are, what is the health professional's primary responsibility? For whom do we really work? Who do we answer to when the patient becomes incompetent or when the patient dies? The answer to these questions should be our primary responsibility is to the patient. I'm here to tell you that the reality is that our answers are to the families, to the courts, to our peers, and not necessarily to the patient. About a year ago, the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled on its right to die decision to deny the withdrawal of a feeding tube in a 65-year-old vegetative patient in a nursing home. The decision was based on the fact that with the feeding tube, this lady would live for years. Without the feeding tube, she would die within a very short period of time. The decision was made in spite of investigative findings that this woman did not wish to be kept alive in a vegetative state by artificial means. The answer was not to the patient. The answer was to the court. An elderly lady in the nursing home where I worked had expressed to me, to the other caregivers, and to the physician that she was ready to die. She did not want anything to prolong her life, nor anything done to prolong the process of her dying. Her family could not accept her decision. The inevitable did happen. And I am very sorry to say that our answer was to her family and not to her. In the same nursing home, an elderly gentleman had lived for many years. He was diabetic. He was blind. He was an amputee. And as a progression of his diabetes, he developed renal failure and was hospitalized. After all conservative treatment had been exhausted, he was offered dialysis. This gentleman refused. But his decision was overruled by the public guardian, and dialysis was started. He lived for 2 angry years. He experienced a traumatic death. For when he did finally suffer a cardiac arrest, full resuscitative measures were implemented with no success. Senate Bills 20 and 21 give the individual the right to choose. They change the current practice of answering to the courts, to the families, to peers, to answering to the patient. That's where the answer belongs. It frees up the healthcare provider from fear of litigation of those who survive. I do have a few recommendations. On Senate Bill 20, I do recommend that you maintain that life-sustaining procedures include mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration. These are invasive treatments. They can cause great discomfort to patients when often they serve only to prolong the process of dying. Currently, as has been testified previously, there is no clear law stating that IVs or tube feedings are life-sustaining procedures or if they're comfort measures. Senate Bill gives the individual the option to decide for himself whether they want to be kept alive with tube feedings or IVs. It gives the individual choice of interpretation. On, pardon me, Senate Bills 20 and 21, just for points of clarification, when it talks about the physician or the healthcare provider not being able to follow through with a directive that the patient will be transferred, I would recommend that it goes further to state that the person be transferred to a physician or facility which will honor the declarant's directive. Are in Senate Bill 21 to say that we'll honor the directions of the attorney in fact. I see no purpose in transferring a patient when their wishes are not going to be followed in with the transfer. I do have a question on Senate Bill 21. It's page 3, section 4, line 10. It says that an employee of the healthcare facility in which the principal is a patient cannot serve as an attorney in fact. I would like to know if that means if I'm an attorney in fact for a friend of mine and I am working at a hospital and my friend becomes a patient at the hospital, does that negate my role as her attorney in fact?
Counsel, you know the answer to that question.
Pardon?
You've raised a good question, and we will bring it up tomorrow in work session or in subsequent work sessions.
I would recommend that I be allowed to be her attorney in fact. There are many employees of healthcare facilities, all the way from nurses, janitors, housekeepers, cooks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, lawns keepers. I am an RN, but I may not be providing care for this patient. I may be working on an entirely different floor. This is an issue that needs to be addressed.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
Here. Dr. Margaret Wason, please.
Senator Frye, members of the committee. There is little that I can add now that has not already been said. There are just two or three aspects here that I would like to mention.
Tell us about your position.
I'm a physician expressing my endorsement of Bill 20. For 20 years, I have been the medical director of the nursing unit of Providence Child Center, which is a 54-bed facility for children that require 24-hour skilled nursing care. There I am the primary physician for most of those children after they're transferred from the acute care facility or from their homes. The center is an institution operated by the Sisters of Providence. I don't speak for them particularly, but as myself, who happens to be a practicing Catholic, but who has cared for all levels of severely damaged children for a great number of years. In earlier times, and you can look at me and see I am representing earlier times, when I started, we didn't have penicillin, we didn't have sulfas, we didn't have all of these things.
And you don't look like you go back that far now.
That's right, that's right. We kept people pretty comfortable, even though we didn't have the present technology that was available. And people did, their nutritional status did deteriorate as they died, but we could keep them comfortable by nursing techniques that were not too imposing on us attending staff. And the other point I would like to make is that in my experience, a patient who's dying of natural causes, these life-sustaining feeding techniques really don't restore the patient. You don't restore this patient to anything that he was before, even nutritionally. All you do is let him chug along. And the other nausea and vomiting are so common that the tube, even in place, does not prevent aspiration pneumonias. We get gastric bleeding from the tubes themselves, and we have had, not uncommonly, we have some kind of a contamination with an abdominal wall infection as a result of that gastrostomy. So that actually we end up treating the complications that the artificial feeding has imposed on us. In the judgment that I'm inclined to make, I can honestly say that the quality of the child's future life is not relevant. In a responsive, though severely handicapped child, we would not question the use of artificial